This is The Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. I'm Major Garrett joining you. I'm so glad you've joined us for the eighth episode of our podcast, The Takeout. More than 750,000 downloads. I put that out there just because our guest has a slightly larger podcast shadow that he casts across the American podcast landscape. We'll get to him in just a second, but I want to let you know the happy sounds you hear around us. The Dubliner Restaurant near Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., opened March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, you get it? St. Patrick's Day, 1974. A watering hole very familiar, certainly to me and lots of Washingtonians. We are joined today by Stephen J. Dubner, who actually, in the world of podcasts, in the world of authorship, needs no introduction. If you know anything about Freakonomics or that entire series of books, he and his partner, collaborator Steve Levitt, are the co-authors of those books. Freakonomics Radio is among the most popular podcasts in America. In any given month, there are 8 million downloads. When we get to this episode, episode 8, we'll have 800,000. So there's an 8 there. There's some zeros. We're just a little bit behind, Steve.
And 8, as we all know, is the luckiest number in China. And China is a country that we all watch closely these days. So
very
I
closely.
Think that's a good harbinger.
Stephen, thank you so much for
my
joining
pleasure.
Us.
My pleasure, yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I've learned in the podcast world is it's important for people who have up-and-coming podcasts, and this, ladies and gentlemen, is one of them, to go on well-established and high-profile podcasts. So this is a little bit of popular podcast cross-pollination.
It's funny. So one thing that's so cool about podcasts, which may be what attracted you to it or not, is that as a publishing model, as a media model, it is, if you think about it, it's got a built-in advantage, which is, look, we should all be very grateful to the people who built this free distribution system, right? iTunes on and on. But what's even better than it being a free and instant delivery system? Look, I grew up in newspapers, as did you.
I did.
Worked at the New York Times. When I was writing, I was an editor and writer at the New York Times. In order to publish, what did I have to have? I had to have a core of editors above or below. I had to have printing presses.
Big
had
one.
Had to buy newsprint and then trucks to deliver.
Lots
now,
of trucks, lots of gasoline.
All of which, I mean, the barriers to entry were massive.
Not to mention the kids on the bicycles.
Exactly, yeah. And now you talk, you edit, you press a button, and it's around the world instantly. And even better than that, if someone likes what you're doing, they subscribe, which means that the next week you don't have to convince them again. If I write books, every time I write a new book, you have to totally re-identify and cajole your audience. With podcasting, it is a community thing. People find what they like, and then they expand their taste within that.
And we have a nice, humble community. We hope to grow it. We call this our Humble Audio Odyssey. And join with me every week for that Humble Audio Odyssey, Steve Shigaris, the political editor at CBS News. Steve, say hello and introduce yourself to the magnificent Stephen J. Dubner.
Hello, Major. I am the Tonto to your Lone Ranger.
Yes, the greatest sidekick in the history of American podcast, Steve Shigaris. Daryl
Steve,
Hall,
who's your
Sean
favorite?
Oates, Tonto.
Who's your favorite sidekick on TV? Let's say comedy.
My favorite sidekick on TV. Well, so the original idea I had for the sidekick today was Ed McMahon to Johnny Carson.
Hey-o.
I don't know what it was. It's just that he was, maybe because he was drunk
funny stuff.
Half the time and he
funny
was
stuff.
Laughing at even the dumbest jokes,
right?
But the laugh, the sound effects, I don't know. I just love watching Ed and the whole Karnak thing, right? Where the intro to Karnak with the hermetically sealed
envelopes,
mayonnaise jar.
We'll get to that eventually. We'll get to that eventually. Gilligan would be my favorite.
But is Gilligan, here's the question. Is Gilligan the
Bob
sidekick?
Bob Denford to Alan Hale,
is
Jr.
Is he the sidekick or is Gilligan really
the straight man?
Who knows?
You know? Sherwood Schwartz, we'd have to ask him. You know, he was the producer and executive producer of Gilligan's Island.
You know, look.
More meaningless television lore from the pop culture world.
As sidekicky as he may have been, or as a buffoon as he may have been, who'd they name the island after?
Right.
That's right.
So, exactly. You know, right. So, Stephen.
That's the kind of insight I bring, by the way, to the world.
Live and large. Yeah. What is, for those, and there may be a couple of people on this podcast who don't know, but even for those who do know, in your own words, what is Freakonomics and what does it tell us about what we don't know, and what we maybe ought to think about when it comes to human behavior and the intersection with economics or money.
So I could, you know, I could describe it very broad or very narrow. I kind of prefer the broad one, which is Freakonomics is kind of whatever we want it to be, because it's really just a partnership that I have with my colleague, as you mentioned, Steve Levitt, who's an economist at the University of Chicago. I'm not an economist. I trained as a journalist, and I like economics, and I like all the social sciences, frankly. And over the years, we've written four books, and then the podcast was something that I kind of started out of boredom. Levitt plays along with me once in a while when I force him to, but it's something that I wanted to do. And basically, we kind of gave ourselves permission to ask whatever questions we wanted about the world. And they're questions that are not the type that would be unfamiliar to either academics or journalists. You know, why does X happen? What does X really cause Y? What's the evidence for that? And so on. But it's always been a bit of a hybrid, a little bit different than standard journalism, in that my partner is an empiricist, someone who works with lots and lots of data. And so what I would like to think is that with Freakonomics Radio, which is mostly my thing, that I've learned enough from him about how to ask a certain kind of question, how to explore it. So if I'm trying to do an episode on Freakonomics Radio now about, you know, whatever, active versus passive investing, about...
Climate change,
anything you name it. You know, the immediate approach is almost always different from what the standard journalistic approach is, and that's because rather than kind of operating from the received wisdom, the dogma, the political positions, and so on, we just gravitate immediately toward the empirical. You try to find researchers who've spent months or years trying to understand these different issues, different problems, and look, we all love a good story and a good anecdote. But too many decisions, important decisions, especially in D.C., are made based on either the last person you happen to speak with or so on, and we try to get away from that.
That's an excellent segue. You are a trained broadcast professional, I can already tell, because we are in Washington, D.C. I've been here since 1990. I first started covering Congress, then I covered the White House, so I know both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, to cite the shop-worn cliche. Every cliche is, of course, shop-worn. And I want to ask you about something you said in relationship to Freakonomics and how it does or does not apply to the work of this city, which is politics, looking at problems and trying to figure them out.
What we try to say is that whatever problem you're trying to solve, poverty, famine, income inequality, a lot of times we define the problem wrong. We look at the thing that bothers us most as opposed to asking a new question and trying to get a new set of solutions.
Wow. Ask a new question, get a new set of solutions. Not exactly conventional methodology in Washington, D.C.
I think a big part of it is, look, it's an inherent conflict. I'm not blaming politicians. I'm not blaming policymakers. The fact is, if your job is to solve the problem or to address it, what do? You kind of pretend or assume that you know how to do that more than you probably should. Now, this is why I like academics and why I feel like academic research is valuable. They're operating from a standard of position of, oh, we don't know the answer to that question. Let's explore it. In politics, because of the nature of the game, and again, I don't blame the players in the game, because of the nature of the game, there is a high value on presenting yourself as if you have the solution to the problem. And that's, we just know, empirically not likely.
But my question is, do politicians do a poor job, do you think, of simplifying what they are trying to, simplifying that solution for people? Or are they complicating it too much? Is it really the simplest answer should be the one that you really...
I think that's
toward?
Tough. I think it can be either. I don't think the simplicity and the expression of the issue is really the thing. I think it's, I hate to agree with myself, but that clip you played, you know, the thing is, what gets people's attention that a problem needs to be addressed is usually a symptom of the problem that's way downstream from the root cause, right? So, like, whether it's a civil war, whether it's famine, whether it's poverty, whether it's inequality, these are things that finally got so inflamed that we feel the need to address them. And what do? We try to put out that fire as opposed to the fires that started 100 miles or 10 years ago.
I asked the question about simplicity mainly because it seems some people would argue that Donald Trump, he campaigned on simple answers to complex problems.
Yeah.
And it seemed to work for him. So I guess my question is that sort of the direction this country is going?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, look, I'm whenever I'm asked what direction anything is
or
going
has
in,
been going for the last 70 years.
Yeah, I
since
mean,
the advent of the modern media, maybe.
Also, just, you know, predicting the future is, you know, a fool's game, at least for me. I mean, I know that, look, people make a good living off it. But then when you go back and see how they actually did, unless you have skin in the game, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't blame people for wanting the simple answer. We all do. Should I do this thing or not? No one wants to hear the answer, well, it's complicated. It depends, you know. Or you have a 60% chance of it turning out well. Is that good enough to do it? But life was never meant to be binary, mm-hmm. you know.
And the choices are complicated. The options, many, and the definitional choice, not always clear. But one definitional choice that is absolutely clear, today's lunch. Corned beef and cabbage, please. Mm.
Steven?
I'm going to just stick with unsweetened iced tea.
There we go. All right.
Okay. I love to eat, and I would love some corned beef and cabbage, but if I eat corned beef and cabbage in moment zero, in moment 45, I need to sleep.
Right. There's nap time involved.
And I have, unfortunately, I have some work to do.
Hopefully,
we
wouldn't put you to sleep.
Yep.
I'm going to go with the fish and chips with extra tartar sauce. Mm.
And that's good. So we have our lunch order in. We're at the Dubliner. That's the happy sound you hear around us. We are joined by Stephen J. Dubner, Freakonomics, and all of the assorted empire. You are listening to The Takeout.
We don't care about politics. We aren't interested in politics. And so consequently, when we're controversial, we're, I don't know, equal opportunity offenders across the political spectrum.
With issues that become controversial, do you set out to have controversial results?
We generally don't write about something unless we have something new to add. And by nature of being new and different, it will definitely raise some hackles just because it challenges the orthodoxy.
Challenging the orthodoxy, that's the voice of Stephen J. Dubner. In between that was Martha Teichner, a colleague of mine at CBS News. And before that, that was the voice of Steve Levitt, your collaborator, Stephen Dubner. That was from a piece in 2014 on CBS Sunday Morning, an excellent show, by the way, talking about the Freakonomics phenomenon and the idea and the construct that you and Steve Levitt brought to interesting behavioral aspects of the world around us and how we might evaluate problems and solutions differently than we had before. When you started this enterprise, I'm really curious about how people start and what becomes of what they start. I'm guessing you had no idea it would become what it's become.
Yeah, no, it was total surprise. And actually, so it began, I was in the middle of, I guess, my third book. I had been at the New York Times for a few years. And I decided, I mean, this was kind of part of the journey. I decided I did not want to be an employee anymore. And that was a hard decision to make because I was, I grew up in a upstate New York, the middle of nowhere, the last of eight kids.
Which town?
Called Duanesburg outside of, you know it? You're kidding.
It was the halfway point on my drive from Lynn, Massachusetts to Ithaca College.
Oh, yeah.
I-88.
Right. So you're quite a bit younger than me, plainly, because I moved away right as I
before the interstate
was opening up.
Senator Warren M. Anderson
exactly.
Expressway. Yes.
You're right, the personal highway route.
Interstates are like the rings on a tree for American life. You know,
Duanesburg,
when do the interstates show up?
Yeah, so you
how
went,
old are we?
You went about a third of a mile from the house where I grew up.
Wow.
On Gallupville Road in Quaker Street, technically outside of Duanesburg. So my dad was a newspaper man, and I always liked the idea of I loved the idea of being in journalism, and then when I ultimately got through a series of kind of misjudgments on the behalf of hiring people, when I got to the New York Times, I was like, holy cow, I can't believe I'm here. And I loved it. But after 4 years, I just I decided to be the writer I wanted to be. I didn't want to be an employee. And I wanted to write books also. So I began, and I was in the middle of my third book, which was about what I call the psychology of money. I was very taken with the work of a guy who's quite well known by now, Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel in economics, even though he's a psychologist. And he had done a bunch of work with a colleague named Amos Tversky.
And they're getting a lot of heat right now. Michael Lewis wrote a really wonderful book called The Undoing Project.
Right.
Danny Kahneman wrote a wonderful book called Thinking Fast and Slow a few years ago. And basically, they brought to they were psychologists who asked a very basic question, which was, what do we know about how people actually think and make decisions? And you might think, well, first of all, don't we know that? The answer is no, because so much behavior, especially in politics, but in economics and so on, is decisions that aren't as rational as we might think. But then they also had the good fortune to write these papers in a way that a bunch of economists adopted their school of thinking and turned it into what we now know as behavioral economics. So I was working on a book about that when I met Steve Levitt, who had nothing to do with behavioral economics. Steve Levitt was this wonderfully weird scholar, an applied microeconomist who'd done studies on sumo wrestlers and real estate agents and cheating school teachers. And all it had in common was he was very good at getting hold of interesting data sets and asking interesting questions of it. And I didn't even, when I was asked to go write a piece about Steve Levitt for the New York Times Magazine, I was so stupid, I actually turned down the assignment three times. And then finally I was...
How journalism actually works, kids.
Yeah. I mean, through sheer dumb luck, I was going to be in Chicago for something else. I said, you know what, let me look at Levitt's papers. And I went to interview him, and that article I wrote about him for the New York Times then spurred some interest from publishers, and we, but again, you know, in journalism, when you cover someone, you're not on their team, you know?
Right, no.
So Levitt was on the other team, so
you're trying to pull information out of them and contextualize it and tell a story.
And he's trying to protect himself from you to some degree.
Of course.
So after the article came out, when people suggested that we maybe write a book together, we were both averse to it.
Right.
So no, we're not allies. But then
How dare you? Then
we talked about it and thought, you know, it would be crossing no line. It's after the fact. And then we started to work together, and it's just been a great partnership. He's taught me a great deal.
And I'm not going to ask you to roll through your entire resume, but let people have a appreciation. These are massively successful books.
They do okay.
Come on. Millions of copies.
Back when people bought books, yeah.
Right, exactly. I want to read something to you and talk about this as a concept for people who have something that is creative and that they have manufactured themselves. You said once, as a writer, there's nothing more important to me than owning and controlling every single second. It reminds me of something I heard Howard Stern say many, many years ago. And Howard Stern, whatever you think about his approach to radio, is a massively successful media persona and a tremendous broadcaster. But I remember him saying something that I've never forgotten. Don't ever do anything for free. Don't ever do anything for exposure. Own your content, believe in its creative weight, and make someone pay you for it.
Mm-hmm. I don't
go
that far.
Do you think those two things are analogous, or what do you come down on that creative sense of what you have to do to make your creative life both meaningful and profitable?
Yeah, I think that's a really compelling question for a lot of people, and a lot of people outside of what we do, right? Media is kind of set up for different degrees of control or different degrees of entrepreneurship or freedom. But, you know, every industry now is getting more elastic in terms of what you control, what you don't. For me, when I say I want to own every second, what I mean is, you know, I think one thing that people really underestimate is the cost of different kinds of interactions and transactions with people, right? So if I'm obliged, like if I work, if I'm an employee, here's what I didn't like. I don't control my schedule, which means that if there's a meeting at 10:30, an editorial meeting at 10:30, and it's going to last an hour, that's an hour of my life that will, look, in all likelihood, be spent very inefficiently. And then what if whoever's controlling that meeting says, oh, we got to bump it to 11:30? Well, now I've kind of lost an additional hour because the thing that I could have. So opportunity, what economists call opportunity costs,
right?
It's one of the most underappreciated elements of economics for people individually. Every time you spend a dollar or a minute or a brain cell on something, there's something else that you're not. And so that's what I mean by I want to control every second. Doesn't mean I don't waste time and procrastinate, but my basic criteria for whether to do a project are it needs to be two out of three of the following: intellectually stimulating, fun, and or profitable. I'm happy to do things that are fun and intellectually stimulating if I lose money, but if they're only any one of those three is not enough. Something just for money, if it's not fun or intellectually stimulating, won't do it.
I think a lot of people probably agree with what you were saying about your schedule at work and all that. How do you get out of that? I mean,
quit. You just got to quit.
Right, but I mean, it's not that easy.
Which is,
right?
which is an act of courage on its own.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question.
And some people do like that structure too,
yeah,
right?
And it's not, and even if you don't, it's not like firms are going to go away, right? Firms are kind of the way that we organize ourselves. But, so here's what I say. I would say it is incumbent upon the people running the firms to recognize that people do their best work when they have a lot of things that they typically don't have now, which is a certain amount of not just autonomy but flexibility, a certain amount of input into something. And there are a lot of things that, again, empirically have been shown to be really helpful. For instance, there are a lot of people in any organization, let's say it's a company, who may have really good ideas, may have all kinds of good suggestions, but by nature of their personality, maybe they're a little quiet, maybe they're an introvert, maybe they don't like to stand up and boast about their, you know, proclivity for idea making, right? Those people often don't get heard. Well, that's a big loss for the firm. So, like, there are little things that a manager can do. For instance, every time you have a meeting, make sure that you've heard from everyone. And if there's two people you haven't heard from, you know, I say to you,
go around the room.
Yeah, Steve, you know, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this. Major, look, I don't think you guys are going to be the kind who have a hard time speaking up. But it's really,
I can't remember a single meeting when I didn't pipe up. I cannot remember one.
Yeah, but I mean,
after a few too many Guinnesses, maybe.
I don't know what you're talking about.
He gets quiet then.
Before we go to break, I want to ask you about something that is relevant, I think, to this last election. And it brings up the question of the usefulness of probabilities, the predictive nature of politics. And I think there was a certain period of time, maybe the last two or three election cycles, where the quant side of political science really rose up and became, if not the owners of, certainly the representatives of, quantitative analysis can tell us a lot about the future. Yeah. And then we had the election in 2016, and they were sort of knocked back a little bit. Talk about the inherent weaknesses or vulnerabilities of probabilities and what they ought to remind us about politics and the 2016 election.
Well, there's so much to say about this. And look, there are a lot of dimensions on which you guys know so much more about me, so I want to be careful not to try to bring coals to Newcastle on this. But I will say this. First of all, people misunderstand what a probability is. If I say there's a 70% probability of Hillary Clinton winning the election, that means that there's a 30%, right? So, like, if you see, look, meteorologists are among the best at doing this. Part of it is science, and part of it is covering your ass, right? So if I say that there's a 30% chance of showers tomorrow, that means it's more likely than not that it won't rain. But if it does rain, well, I said there was a 30% chance. Is 30% huge? No, but is it non-zero? Yes. So first of all, I would argue that people, even a lot of people who talk about probabilities or odds, look, Leicester City won the English Premier League last year. They went off at 5,000 to 1. Now,
right.
Theoretically, that is something about like infinity. There's only a couple dozen teams in a league. So plainly, you know, if they're in the league, there's a possibility. So that's number one. Number two is, you know, like computer scientists are fond of saying garbage in, garbage out. When it comes to making a model, I'm not saying that polling is necessarily garbage, but...
but bad polls get mixed in with good polls.
Exactly.
And then they distort what we understand about the underlying data.
And then there are the people who work really hard and do a pretty good job of weighting, of assessing the validity of an individual set of data, like Nate Silver is the most famous. And look, I think Nate's really good. Before I get back to Nate, one other thing about this that people just don't appreciate, predicting the future is just difficult, period.
That's why you don't do it.
So right.
That's why, I mean, you know, I am tempted like everybody, but if you look at the data, we've looked at data. We did a podcast episode once called The Folly of Prediction, where we looked at pundits and experts, the most highly paid, the most appreciated in four different realms. Sports betting, the USDA and corn prices over time, stock markets, and geopolitics. And in each very different case, different scenarios, different group of experts. And in each case, on average, the pundits, the experts, were about as good as a monkey with a dartboard. Mm. Okay, so what does that tell you? It tells you that our obsession with figuring out what's going to happen at the expense of either planning for contingencies or whatnot is really a cost that we're all bearing. But let me get back to Nate Silver then. Nate, I think ultimately the day of the election had Clinton at about 70%, 68%, right? Then he was attacked afterwards. A lot of people saying, wait a minute, you said, right?
You said, and you promised us.
And this is where I think he made his one mistake. He said, I think it was just in a tweet or a series of tweets, something to the effect of, what people don't understand is if I said there was a 28 or 32% chance of an earthquake happening, kind of like what I said earlier with the meteorologist, and then it happens, you can't say, well, you said it wasn't going to happen. Mm. I said there was a chance of it happening. The problem is this, however. There's a big difference between an earthquake, which is a much rarer event, and a political campaign, which is literally a binary choice. It's red or blue.
One
it's yes
or the
no.
other.
One or the other, right? So for anyone to be really gobsmacked by the fact that the one with a 30% chance won in a scenario like this, look, you guys have self-tortured. You've done a lot of self-torturing about how did we miss it? Well, and maybe you missed it less than others because you were covering the campaign.
Right.
And I'm sure you saw a lot of things. Ex post, everybody has an explanation, and the worst of it, and this is one thing that ticks me off a little bit, the pundits who make predictions that turn out to be wrong are the most aggressive in explaining why I was really right, but then things on the ground changed, or I was really right, but I didn't have all the data. If you had that, it wouldn't be a prediction.
So one thing we're never going to talk about on this podcast is my acts of self-torture. I mean, just so everyone understands. Just so everyone understands. That was the voice of Stephen J. Dubner. He is our guest for episode 8 of The Takeout. We are at the Dubliner. Lunch has arrived. So in our ever...
For some of us.
Yes. Well, it has for me. And so that really is all that matters. Sauce. And it is our never-ending pursuit, Stephen, of trying to prove that, yes, it's possible. It is possible. To obtain a free lunch, you are listening to The Takeout.
In 2014, women made 83 cents for every dollar earned by a man. Single women without children earned 94 cents for each dollar earned by a man, whereas married mothers made only 77 cents. As researchers have noted, gender is no longer the factor creating the greatest wage discrepancy in this country. Motherhood is.
That voice, Ivanka Trump, the venue, Quicken Loans Arena, the city, Cleveland, Ohio, the event, the Republican National Convention, July 21st, 2016. And who better than to pick apart the issue of wage discrepancy in the workplace than three white men? I mean, I right. can't think of a better
perfect
gathering. Steve Shigaris is with me. I'm Major Garrett, joined by Stephen J. Dubner of Freakonomics fame. You've done some podcasts on this, some clinical and critical analysis of the underlying data. When Ivanka Trump makes that statement, it's a little bit more attenuated than the sort of condensed version of pay either discrimination or discrepancy. Talk to us about
that. Yeah, honestly, that was, I think, my single favorite moment of the presidential campaign. I'm not kidding, and I didn't know you were going to play that cut. I loved it because she got it exactly right. In fact, it's hard to say how to get it exact. It's a very complicated set of calculations, but the bottom line is this. The standard argument that women get paid 77%, lets a lot of people argue, of what men get paid for the same work is plainly very, very wrong in a number of dimensions. But again, then you have to start to get in the weeds to explain why it's wrong. Here's this very simple example. You might look at, let's say, 100 lawyers, 50 female, 50 male. And if they're categorized only as lawyers, then you look at overall pay. And you might say that the women end up getting, you know, on average, let's say 80% of what the men get. But then you have to drill down and see, well, what kind of lawyers are they? Well, the fact is that women who are more likely to be mothers than men, much more likely to be mothers than men, or I should just say less cheekily, much more likely to be the primary caregiver in a family than a man, they are more likely to have a job like a general counsel, not a litigator, not something that requires, something that requires more what you call temporal flexibility, able to shift time a little bit. So it's complicated because It involves everything from selection bias to choices and so on. The fact is, what you want to guarantee is that if two people are doing the same work, that they're paid the same, regardless of gender. The evidence seems to suggest that we're a lot closer to that than the bald exploitation of women than one end of the political argument would suggest. And in fact, if you just think about it logically for a minute, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because if employers could get a great woman for 77 cents on the dollar for the great man, why on earth would they ever hire any men? Right? It would make almost no sense. So the bottom line is, there is a gender pay gap. Some of it, but probably a relatively very small percentage, is caused by discrimination. I'm not saying there isn't any, but the amount of that is much, much smaller than kind of dogmatists would have you believe. And therefore, it's important to find people like Claudia Golden, an economist at Harvard who studied this and who we report on. Find people who really understand the data and can help draw out the picture, because ultimately what you want is a solution. You don't want a talking point. You want a solution.
So, but that undercuts arguments that I think political arguments that people want to make, right? So
not my problem.
Right. Well, there you go. But how do you? How do you educate people to listen to other points of view on these things when there's such compelling numbers that are being thrown around?
You are asking the $64,000 question. How do you get people?
Game show reference. We'll get there.
How do you get people to entertain even the possibility that the way that they're looking at a problem is not right? And the answer is, it is really hard, perhaps almost impossible, for a few reasons. One, if you're invested in anything, right, it's really hard to get talked off it, especially if you have a financial investment in it or a vocation. If my job is to promote the idea of pay inequality, you can show me all the data you want. I'm not going to spend time on it. I'm not going to believe in it. Additionally, the smarter a given person is, the more likely they are, believe it or not, to hold an extreme view on whatever topic you're talking about. Could be nuclear disarmament, nuclear power, gun control. And that's because smarter people tend to consume more information, but they also tend to consume information that confirms their pre-existing priors, and they tend to be smart enough to avoid anything that might contradict their views.
Well, you're talking about where our political... what our political culture is right now, right? And so how do you have any idea how to get past that?
Look, you're talking to like the windmill tilter. I do it every week. I make a show. This is what I spend my time doing. It's not like I'm like not some selfless guy on a mission to educate, blah, blah, blah. It's not my thing. But we put out a show, Freakonomics Radio, every week, and this new show that we started, Tell Me Something I Don't Know, which is, it's kind of live journalism posing as a game show, mm-hmm. but really the whole idea is to flesh out more information on a given topic. And the idea is, all I'm trying to do is say, look, whatever the topic today may be, mountaintop coal mining, women's pay, whether people should really wear belts, we do some ridiculous ideas too. The idea is, we try our best to assemble a lot of information and present it in a way that if people are open to listening, they might either find new information or even change their minds. But look, I'm a failure. I have one of the biggest podcasts in the world, and I think the only thing that we've ever accomplished, there are two things I know. One is, we've done a couple episodes on kidney donor, the kidney exchange idea, how there's a great shortage and that many people could donate more because we all have two. It's one of the few total redundancies. And so we know we've heard from several people who have given an altruistically donated kidney so I feel good about that. And then the only other thing I think we've accomplished is we've written about how if you just tested dogs for DNA when you gave them a license, then you could end the dog poop problem by then scooping the poop, testing the DNA, and sending a ticket for $200 to the owner. That was our other brilliant idea. And I think we've made a little – that's actually been adopted. So I think that's our big policy effect.
Perfect lunch conversation, by the way. Anyway,
you're welcome.
Goes very well with my corned beef and cabbage. I'm going to disagree with you. Oh, Timmy the Wonder Cat is not going to like that sound effect. I'm going to disagree with you in one sense, because in economic terms, you can't know the present value of an idea. You can't even know the future value of an idea. And there are a tremendous number of ideas you are putting into the sphere of conversation and the sphere of ideas. And you and I may not know for 10, 20, 30 years what their present or future value is. So I'm going to disagree with you about the failure.
It's nice of you to say so, but I'll tell you, it's just, look, you guys know the leverage that exists in politics. It's just so massive. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. It's just the way the system is set up. And so to change the way that thinking happens about problem solving, or even what kind of problems should be solved by government. I mean, that's another big, big component of this. It's a really big ship to move. And as we know, no ships turn on a dime. So, you know.
And let's talk about problems for a second. And I'm going to take a point of personal privilege here and tell a story about my sainted mother, who died 3 years ago. Kale and Garrett grew up in Moline, Illinois. She moved to San Diego, where I was born. She was a telephone operator for AT&T when it was a monopoly. She rose to become a long-distance engineer without a college degree. And in the 1960s, she was absolutely, by corporate edict, paid less than men for the exact same work. Mm. The exact same work. Engineers were paid much more who were men than my mother, who was an engineer doing exactly the same job. And when she found out about it, she said, "Pay me what men make or I'm walking out the door." As the only female engineer in San Diego, California. Mm. Now, AT&T could have said, "Go ahead. There's 100 other guys who can do what you're doing." But they said no. For whatever reason, the people within that office said, "You're right. It's unjust. We're going to pay you what men pay." There has been progress on this front. Those and a lot of the research I read about what you talked about, if you do the equivalent job and do it for the same hours under the same circumstances, there is an equivalency that has been gained over time. 2 points. Does that obscure progress, do we sometimes forget about advances made and not appreciate them enough or not value them enough? And does the data confuse us about what the actual problem may or may not be?
Yeah. So I'll answer your first question first. Do we, you know, psychologists have a number of terms for it. Not assimilation, but I can't think of the term now. Basically, whenever we get a gain, I mean, look, big picture for a minute. The world, the earth, is more prosperous, healthier, safer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, today than it's ever been by a long shot. And yet, why are we so upset about so many things? So I would say two things about it. One is, I think that's a good feature of humanity. That when we...
The striving component.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, every religion has a component of, you know, no matter how good things may be for you individually or for you as a society, you know, do your best to try to fix your corner. So I think that's good. But in terms of our lack of appreciation, like you said, it is a huge issue. There's a nice theory that we feature in an upcoming episode of Freakonomics Radio. It's called the Headwinds, Tailwinds Asymmetry. And what that means is this. Imagine you're facing the physical headwinds or tailwinds, riding a bike or running. When you're into the wind, when you've got a headwind, man, do you feel it. And every minute you're thinking about, I can't wait until the course turns or the wind turns because I am going against the tide. What happens when it turns and you have it at your tail? For about 3 seconds, you say, oh, that's better. And then you forget it, okay? Apply that asymmetry to the rest of our lives. All the privilege or opportunity that any one given person or institution may have, right? It's very easy to forget about, man, I was born on third base or second base or first base, okay? That's the danger of that. But then the danger of the tailwinds problem is if you can see only tailwinds, then it makes you very resentful, makes you very hard to kind of operate in a collaborative environment and so on. So I think that it works both ways. I think, yes, we need to better appreciate the progress we've had while not letting the future progress so frustrate us or make us resentful that we say, well, the system's broken, the system's working against us, it can't be fixed. In terms of the data on pay equity and trying to figure it out, you know, it'd be great if the world were simpler and you could just like look in the column that says it's more or it's less. But there are a lot of variables. And so what you have to do when you have a lot of variables is turn to people who spent their entire lives trying to match variables and measure them against each other. Economists and others do this thing that's called regression analysis. And it's
political scientists do it
as
well.
Yeah. And it's a great tool. It's only a tool. It's not the solution to everything. It's not a magic wand. But look, I'm a big believer that that the more analytical you can be about the problem you're trying to solve, and the less dogmatic if you can walk in without a kind of fixed concept of what it is. And that's, again, why I like academics. They walk around every day not pretending to know something, but saying, you know, I don't understand this. I'd like to figure it out. How do we do that?
That's the voice of Stephen J. Dubner. Journalistically, just like me, not born on second base, not born on third base, probably born out near where the scalped tickets are sold and purchased. I'm Major Garrett. This is the obligatory social media script part of our show, The Takeout. Please listen ever so carefully. Brand new episodes of The Takeout are available, and we promise you this, every Friday morning we invite you to subscribe, rate, and comment on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You know, like you do with Freakonomics Radio, just in big numbers, big, big numbers. Go to thetakeoutpodcast.com. That's takeoutpodcast.com. Follow us and like us. Oh, please, please like us. On Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. Hate the show? Love the show? Need, want to vent? That's a behavioral part of life. We understand. Do any of the above at takeoutpodcast@cbsnews.com from the Dubliner Restaurant near Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. I'm Major Garrett with Steve Shigaris and Stephen J. Dubner of Freakonomics. This has been The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Nick Feynman, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
Failing pile of garbage.